Hi, I'm Brian McCreath, and this is The Answered Question from WCRB in Boston for October 14th, 2016. This is one of the more riveting parts of the Brahms Requiem, as performed last Saturday night at Symphony Hall in Boston. Andras Nelsons led the Boston Symphony Orchestra and the Tanglewood Festival Chorus. It was a gorgeous, heartfelt performance that we broadcast live at the time that it happened. And now you can hear the entire concert at our website, classicalwcrb.org, on demand. This weekend is a very different program, which we will once again have for you live on the radio at 99.5 FM in Boston and streaming at classicalwcrb.org. Jakob Ruscha is the conductor in his BSO debut, and Frank-Peter Zimmermann is the soloist in Bartok's second violin concerto. And you'll hear about all of it from Jakob Ruscha on this podcast. Also this weekend, on Sunday at 7 p.m., Chris Voss brings you WCRB in concert with Boston Baroque in Mozart's The Magic Flute. And you'll find more info about that at classicalwcrb.org. Just look for In Concert under Programs. And coming up later in the podcast, I have an interview from Tanglewood with conductor Juanjo Mena, who led two concerts there last summer. But before we go further, I just want to highlight one part of the other piece on last week's BSO concert, Jörg Widmann's Trauermarsch. If you didn't catch The Answered Question last week, you might go back and listen to pianist Yefim Bronfman talk about it. And when you do, you'll hear us mention this one moment when the chaos and complexity of the piece gradually dissipates to leave the piano soloist almost alone with a really simple, sweet song. It's almost shocking when it happens, and to me, the effect makes all that complexity that surrounds it even more powerful. And I like what Yefim Bronfman had to say about it last week when he said maybe it's sort of a vision of heaven or whatever, but it does depend on every individual listener's interpretation to make some sense of it. We'll take a listen to the whole piece by going to classicalwcrb.org. As I mentioned, Jakob Ruscha is the conductor this week at the BSO, and he's leading a program that begins with Sarka from Bedřich Smetana's collection of pieces called My Country. Then Frank-Peter Zimmermann is the soloist in Bartok's Violin Concerto No. 2. And on the second half of the program, the orchestra plays Mussorgsky's Night on Bald Mountain, which they've probably played about 1,000 times, and Leos Janáček's Taras Bulba, which the orchestra has never played. There are a lot of connections among these pieces, like the fact that the Smetana, the Mussorgsky, and the Janáček all depict stories that involve war, revenge, and killing. And the stories behind the Mussorgsky and Janáček have connections to the Russian novelist Nikolai Gogol. Beyond that, if you're keeping score at home, there are two pieces by Czech composers and two pieces by non-Czech composers. That's a topic Jakub Ruscha and I talked about when I met him at Symphony Hall earlier this week after a rehearsal, and he had some really interesting things to say that sort of gives us a window into the life and work of a conductor these days. But I began by asking him how familiar he was before this week with the sound of the Boston Symphony.
I'm pretty familiar with it on the recordings. Actually, if I count my hundreds of CDs, a big portion of them would be with the Boston Symphony. I've heard the orchestra only a couple of times live, and I've never been to Boston. That means I've never been to the Symphony Hall here. So that's a complete discovery for me.
Yeah, and how does it strike you in comparison to the other halls where you've conducted?
It's one of the best halls in the world, that's for sure. It's fantastic that on the stage you get pretty same image of the sound as in the hall itself, and that's something so valuable for us conductors, because usually it's exactly the opposite. So very often, especially in the opera houses, the conductor gets the worst sound image of all participating. And here it feels very pleasant. It's a cultivating hall. That means it helps everyone playing reach even nicer result. And it has a very beautiful richness of sound and a great volume about itself. Of course, I'm still in the process of getting familiar with it, so I'm trying to see how much of a dynamic range one can get and things like that. But it's generally a great pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So we'll talk about the program and especially the two pieces that begin and end the concert. And I wonder, when you first heard that you would have the opportunity to come here, was it something that you really wanted to do, to bring Czech composers here to Symphony Hall and work with the BSO?
Well, first of all, only 50% of the program is Czech.
Yes.
And
yes.
Considering how the world works, that means that people very much like to connect their knowledge of people with their knowledge of countries and nationalities and so on. It's a very straightforward way. And of course, it happens to me quite a lot. Sometimes it's a great advantage and sometimes it's a trap, because you sometimes think, I want to do so much of the other things, but you ask to do Czech repertoire only. Here, it was the most sensible result we got. I'm not only bringing Czech music, but also Hungarian and Russian music, which is fantastic. And on top of it, the Czech music I'm bringing is unknown, basically, or less known, if you will. There are definitely many people who know it very well, but generally it's not the same as the New World Symphony. And that I find as a meaningful mission, of course. For me, it's the closest possible repertoire with which I've been living since childhood. And for Boston, it may be a discovery. So I find that very beautiful and stimulating.
Yeah, and you know, if you were going to choose something from Vlast, I think that a lot of people would have assumed the Moldau would come to the top of the list, but you chose Sarka instead. And tell me about that choice. What is it that brought you to that piece for this concert?
There are two answers, among others. One is, it's a masterpiece. And the second, it's a piece which very much fits the character and atmosphere of the other pieces in the program. It's not as easy to put it into words, but the whole program definitely has some wildness and luscious, bloodthirsty aspects about themselves, the composition. And I think at least pieces by Smetana and Janáček have very particular program, which is full of kind of, how to say that? I mean, very, almost military adventure, and but put in a very cultured way. It's very wild. It describes histories from a long time ago. And in both pieces, programmatically, it's about a fervent and passionate fight of one group against another, and a certain love, passion involved in all of it. Both of these stories are worth reading before the concert starts or even during. And I spent also minutes long telling the orchestra what was each piece about, because I think it's completely necessary to get the full message about them.
The Janáček that you brought is Taras Bulba, which is the first time the BSO has played this piece. And so what is it that challenges the orchestra with this piece that they may not have encountered in other music that they've played before?
First of all, Janáček's music, his writing, his way of putting music on paper is extremely personal and particular and not easy to decipher. I would say that Janáček music is still easier to listen to than to read. His way of composing was extremely abrupt, immediate, and sometimes so quick and stormy that he, you know, after having finished his work, he left a lot of remnants on the floor. And I think it just takes time to get used to his, as we say, idiom, to his way of composing. And on top of it, it's simply technically very demanding. It's a piece which takes a lot of energy to perform. And there are a lot of particular puzzling rhythms and structures which, when you play just one instrument in the orchestra, are not easy to understand. So it just needs time to settle. And then as soon as it settles, it must take off. So that's what I find difficult about the piece. Also, Janáček composes his sound image is very unlike any other composer. He likes to use instruments in their edge registers, you know, not normally somehow. So very high registers of high instruments and very low registers of low instruments. And it takes a lot of effort, actually, to really lift to the to all details of the characters encoded in music. So that's what I suppose is the challenge we have to tackle.
And this really fascinates me, because I wonder, in your work with orchestras in the Czech Republic, they, I'm going to presume, maybe play this music more often than American orchestras do. And as a result, I wonder if those instincts for creating the kinds of textures you're talking about, creating the kind of image, as you put it, that you're talking about, does that simply come more naturally to them and therefore create that image more quickly, maybe?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily speak about speed of work, because there is some exemplary result here in the States. I mean, you simply put things quickly together. However, I think there are composers, such as Janáček, who necessarily need a bit more time to digest. Janáček in the Czech Republic is a different story, because it's a composer who is equally frequently played as Dvořák, for instance. It's just in the same realm of knowledge. And it's taught at school, so basically the players in the orchestra simply always have some knowledge of how to play Janáček. Majority of orchestra players would have also gone through some chamber music experience or are currently chamber music players as well. And Janáček has written at least the string quartets and some music for wind ensembles and a lot for brass and so on. So the idiom is known. I am happy to say that Janáček recently, in the last decades, let's say, is much more familiar in Europe in general. It is really due to his popularity, I would even say, not exactly the same popularity as Puccini, but really he would be, next to Strauss and Debussy and Britten, one of the most important operatic composers of the 20th century. And the orchestras get knowledge how to play Janáček from there as well. I would say, anyway, that piece like Taras Bulba, which is slightly more complicated than some other scores of Janáček, for instance, there's this famous Sinfonietta, which is demanding to play, but is encoded slightly more easily. There are not so many rather unclear tempo transitions and abrupt changes of character and so on. But and nevertheless, Janáček simply will always remain a difficult composer. What I find fascinating here in the States, there is an immediate sense of how beautifully the orchestra gets the rhythms and the structure and the direction of the piece. It's incredibly professional, and you can start very, very high musically. It's interesting, and I have met that at many places in the world. Janáček kind of opposes this immediate success. It always takes more time to get used to it. But what my experience says, and I've done Taras Bulba 30 times, that in the end, when the nut is really uncracked and the whole beauty of the contents can appear, that it's very satisfactory. It's somehow personally incredibly powerful experience to get to play Janáček well. And that's what drives me somehow to suggest it, even if I know that it's so difficult.
Wow, that is all so fascinating. Thank you for unpacking that. That's really terrific. And as you say, Czech music is only 50% of this program. So in terms of the other works, Frank-Peter Zimmermann is someone, have you worked with him before? And what is it that he brings to the Bartok Second Violin Concerto that really makes that piece come alive?
We've done many projects with Frank-Peter. Actually, he definitely would be one of my most favorite collaborators on stage. Definitely so. And what he brings to Bartok too, well, he does bring exactly the same thing as into all concertos, which I've done with him, and we've done many, starting with Shostakovich and Dvořák and, less usual things like Shostakovich 2 as well. We're going to do Prokofiev and things to come after. He simply plays with the most amazing technique and most amazingly straightforward musicality, exactly what's written. And that, I find, it sounds black and white, doesn't it? It almost sounds inappropriate to say that, but you can't imagine how many artists, soloists, because they want to be personal and because we all expect them to bring something personal, how far they get from what's in the music. And Frank-Peter never betrays what the composer left. And although someone can find this maybe not as fashionable, I personally believe it's so trustworthy and so elegant in the end and so personally satisfying that connected to his virtuosic violin playing, I just find him really one of the totally best.
Yeah, and the Night on Bald Mountain has a connection to Taras Bulba through the author Gogol, and maybe even a little bit of that sort of bloodthirstiness that you described earlier. Is that kind of what's behind the choice of that piece for this program as well?
I think so. I mean, Janáček and his choice of topic for Taras Bulba was very East European oriented culturally, not politically, but culturally. And we were trying to find some piece to accompany Taras Bulba in the second half of the program. We thought, I thought, and the whole team of who prepared the program thought, a Russian piece would be appropriate. And I think this wild piece of Mussorgsky, although not in the original version, but arranged by Rimsky-Korsakov, is just very fitting. Also because it finishes, this particular version of it finishes so subtly and so beautifully with ethereal feeling, which creates a most beautiful bridge into almost with immediacy starting Taras Bulba. It's an interesting point about Taras Bulba. It doesn't start with a typical opening. The top of the piece is as if you open the book on page 10. Not on page one. So let's say that Mussorgsky is really a foreword, a preface to the next piece of the program.
That's a great way to put it, because that's exactly what it feels like. It feels like you've just walked in the middle of a story, and it's like you turned on the TV in the middle of a show, and you're just like, what? Wait, where? I don't know. But page 10.
But having said that, we must also say that a lot of books have page 1 to 9 just hopeless.
That's right. The quality begins on page 1. Right. Well, it was, I can't resist asking one more question, just because you mentioned it before, and I'd really love to hear what it means when you feel like people make associations with you as coming from Prague and from the Czech Republic and Czech music. And you mentioned that sometimes it's a trap. And does that simply mean that people just expect you to walk in with Dvořák and Smetana? Describe more about how that trap, how you have to navigate through that trap and what you have to do to not fall into it.
Maybe it was a bit strong the word
trap. Okay, fair enough.
People say pigeonhole, right?
Typecast, maybe.
Well, I think what it needs is intelligence.
Okay.
I would say it's understandable because the complexity of the world is beyond all capacity of ours to decode and understand. And if anyone wants to get to know a new artist, it's only understandable that it helps if there is a natural connection with the nationality. And at the same time, I never oppose that nationality. I'm not nationalistic, but I am quite proud on the achievements we have in music particularly. I mean, we are a very small country of 10 million inhabitants, and consider how many fantastic composers and works belonging to standard repertoire we do have. And it's something which fills me with pride, of course. But I also feel responsible for not only taking care of the well-known aspects and parts of the culture, but also bringing to the world something less known about which I am convinced it's a quality. And so the intelligence is needed then to try to suggest meaningful pieces. And at the same time, I have to say that I have never yet met resistance if the suggestion is really good and makes sense for the community where I come, such as in Boston. I've never seen a situation in which people would have said, no, this is simply too unpopular and we just do the usual stuff. We only sometimes hear, all of us artists, that the context of the program must be taken into consideration, and if the program must be on a popular side, you just can't put four unknown pieces. But very often, at the same time, I think people expect from us that we come with creative ideas. And so a program like ours is a mixture of those sensible directions. There is a great deal of discovery. There's also something which people very well know, like Mussorgsky's piece or the presence of Frank Peter. Bartók II is also not unknown. And those two sandwiching pieces will be a great stimulation. Also, Janáček may be a bit unfamiliar, but Smetana is completely in the language which all people can immediately connect with. It's simply a masterpiece of the 19th century, and everyone with open mind, heart, and ears will be able to get fond of it.
Yeah, well put, well put. Jakub Rusza, thank you for your time and welcome to Boston. It's great to talk with you.
Thank you very much and looking forward to all adventure here.
Jakub Rusza leads this week's Boston Symphony Concerts, which include, as you just heard, works by Smetana, Bartók, Mussorgsky, and Janáček. You'll hear it live tomorrow night at 8 p.m. on the radio at 99.5 FM in Boston and streaming live at classicalwcrb.org. That's where you can hear many, many BSO concerts on demand, including concerts from last summer's Tanglewood season. Juanjo Mena led two of those concerts, and he'll be back at Symphony Hall to conduct the BSO in January. In the meantime, you might check out the Tanglewood concerts he conducted. One included Tchaikovsky's first piano concerto with soloist Garrick Olson, as well as Manuel de Falla's The Three-Cornered Hat with soprano Raquel Logiendo. The other, on a Sunday afternoon, began with the Variaciones Concertantes by Ginastera, and continued with Mozart's fourth violin concerto with soloist Veronica Eberle and Beethoven's Symphony No. 6, The Pastoral. When I met Juanjo Mena backstage at the Kuzovitsky Music Shed, I asked him first about each of those soloists and whether he had worked with them before, starting with Garrick Olson.
We did a lot of things together in the last 10 years, and we have a very good friends, and we did beautiful programs with Chopin, with his specialist in this piece. But also we did Barber Concerto, for example, in BBC, with my BBC Philharmonic in Manchester. And this was also amazing. So to have this type of pianist that is so solid, so stable, so a big musician at the same time. No? And now to do Tchaikovsky also with the only things that Tchaikovsky grow, what to say, no extra things than always we put in the music. No? And he's perfect for this. Also, I am very happy to be here.
And he's he's here every summer, and so the audience, everybody, it's he's part of the fabric, so it makes it maybe a little extra.
You choose special. Very well in this case.
That's true. On the same concert, Raquel Lojendo is singing the soprano part for the Three-Cornered Hat, and you even recorded this piece with her. So tell me about your relationship with Raquel and what she brings to that role.
It's strange because she's a soprano, really, but he's singing now the part of the mezzo-soprano. But he has a special color and dark color that work very well because this is only little three little moments in the ballet that she must sing. But one of them is very high, and always with the mezzo-sopranos you have problems, and another one is very low. But this has, he sees this woman have the capacity to have this contrast and dark sound, and also the pronunciation, the pronunciation of the text, the Andalusian pronunciation is amazing, it's wonderful. He knows very well, he has family in also Andalusia, and it's very evident. It's for this I recorded at the end with her, and at the moment one of the better singers for this.
Yeah, yeah. On Sunday, Veronica Eberle is the soloist for a Mozart concerto, and I haven't heard her playing before. Tell me about it.
For me, it's also the first time with her. I'm listening to some other recordings, and I think she chooses very well what to do here with this Mozart concerto, no? Because she's very young, also is growing up now, and she's still with these academy things that is very, very good for Mozart, no? Very, you know, very good technique, very focused technique, and I think it would be fine.
Yeah, yeah. Faya's Three-Cornered Hat is a piece with so much freedom built into it. And there's not a lot of time at Tanglewood. That's one of the defining things about Tanglewood. There's just not a lot of time to put things together. Does that make it a harder piece to do at Tanglewood than, say, in a subscription week when you'd have four rehearsals?
I think so. This is a very, very complex piece. It's because the orchestra and all the suites, also they play it here with one of the best conductors for this music, that was Maestro Fribe de Burgos. No? Okay, it's very clear when I take the suites that they remember all the things that they worked with him, and I recognize the style of so Fribe in this. But the rest of the ballet, that is a lot of time, is all is new, and each bar is moving, is playing to the details, to the character of the corregidor, to the character of the miller's wife, to is playing of the details, change bars, accelerandos, tempi, ritenutos, and it's very complex to have the picture. No? What I do sometimes, and I did also today, is start for the end. You know where you are. You came back some bars before in the new tempo, and when you arrive to the passage that you did before, you recognize and you establish a connection about the tempi change, no? And go is to start in the end and go to the beginning. This is the best thing to do in these very difficult ballets. I did exactly the same when we did Wooden Prince, Bartok, also in Symphony Hall, because it's also it's quite the same and it's very useful, I think.
That's a great technique. I never would have thought of doing that, so that's pretty cool. Yet I also know that you have conducted this piece with choreography, with dancers. And do you feel just more freedom when it's only a concert presentation? I shouldn't say only, but when it is a concert presentation, is it just a little bit easier not to deal with the dancers?
Of course, it's easier, no? But the question is, when the dancers are with us, the musician understand much better all the music. No, this was amazing. When I invest, I think 15 years ago, 2 months in Italy in a little theater, doing with a flamenco company, 2 weeks working the ballet. And I was there each day, knowing each little detail, you know. I recognize all the things that is written in exactly the situations in the stage, you know. And when the dancers are there, immediately the orchestra changed the type of sound and have more character. I try to translate the musicians today without the dances. I dance sometimes, but it's very difficult. But it's true. In some point of view, I can be more free, a little more free.
Yeah, but I never really thought. I even played in a ballet orchestra once, and I never really thought about how that would energize the players in a different way when they see or hear that kind of thing going on.
It was amazing because I recorded with BBC, without ballet. But later we did in the proms. That is a beautiful, it's also on YouTube. You can see, it's amazing. You understand the history. It's not only dancers. They had actors also. And it's amazing. It was the Royal Albert Hall was really crazy. And also they were crazy at the end. And also we do as anchor, Bolero de Ravel with flamenco dancers.
Oh, my God.
And this is another history.
That's... Sounds like a lot of fun. Wow. Well, on Sunday, you're conducting Variaciones Concertantes by Alberto Ginastera. And I wonder what it is about that piece that makes it the right choice to commemorate his centenary. It's for his 100th birthday. And what is it about that piece that really says something about Ginastera?
It's a very difficult piece with a lot of solo. Each member of the orchestra have a so complicated, very difficult solo. And this is the orchestra that can do this. And when we started another day in rehearsal and I start listening to the solo, the cello say, oh, never I saw this level. Alto later, wow. And clarinet, you know. And you know, each one of them, this was a so high level. I think it's a good piece because it's all in the moment of the transition of Ginastera, but it's very complex, very quasi dodecaphonic and very complex. I think this is a good piece also to recognize so high level in the transition of the progression of Ginastera.
It has some echoes of Stravinsky, doesn't it?
Yes, true. Is you can listen a little of the Oedipus Rex, and also the feeling of the instrumentation is also quasi the same. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There are so many ways that conductors approach Beethoven now. I don't know if it's because so many people conduct Beethoven that appears so often. Is there any particular model that you sort of look to for Beethoven symphonies, or how do you find your way, particularly with the Symphony Number 6?
Okay, all of us, we did Beethoven's, but it's so difficult to do good Beethoven. For example, my orchestra proposed me for the next season in BBC Philharmonic to do Eroica, Beethoven 3, and say, no, I am not ready to do this symphony at the moment. I am not ready. I need more time to understand the piece. I don't know. Sometimes it's your proper evolutions, or your evolution is different, and you can serve different point of view. Okay. In my case, when I was studying in Munich with Maestro Celibidache, I was two weeks, listening to rehearsals of Maestro Celibidache working Beethoven 6. 2 weeks. You know, you cannot imagine what was the quality of the marvelous things that I was able to understand there. I was shocked, no? And I am very happy because in some American orchestras, when I did Beethoven 6, they are, no, it's too slow. No, this needs more energetic, because also some reviews here was, why not after the Beethoven 5, Beethoven 6 must continue the line. What do you say? Beethoven 6 is another picture. It's another history. It's no reference about something before 5. No, it's nothing about this. And this is the best place to do this symphony, in the countryside, in so quiet city, in so quiet ambient, in so nice orchestra. And I was very happy yesterday when I start rehearsal, I established my tempos, and all of them understand, and this is the way to do this music. No faster, no exciting, no crazy. Now our life is changing a lot. All must be exciting, all must be crazy, all must be, you know, why? In this time was not this idea.
Yeah, yeah, that's really interesting. I guess I had forgotten that Celibidache was part of your experience, and he was a conductor with sort of special powers that other conductors didn't seem to have, I guess. Tell me a little bit about your work with the BBC Philharmonic. You've been with them for a while now, and what is it? I guess we don't really understand, probably on this side of the Atlantic, what distinguishes the various British orchestras. What do you feel like that orchestra does really, really well? What is it that makes them special?
It's also very good in America, but there the first reading is amazing. It's also, what you say, the honor that they have at 10 o'clock when you put any symphony in the pult to say, I know what is this piece. I play this piece very well. I know any little detail in the piece. I will be looking at you. I'm so waiting in the clarinet. That, you know, this is the attitude of them. To have, you know, a power inside to say, I know. And the ensemble is amazing. The first reading sometimes, and for this is quasi a sport, what to say. They like to do from beginning to the end, the first moment, and look at you and say, what we must do now. You know, it's true. It's as a team, it's amazing. The respect, the ensemble in the sections, it's also very good in America. So the readings here is much better than in another part of Europe, but in England especially is this. And also, why is this? Because they do. You know, I am exhausted all after 5-6 years with this orchestra. We did sometimes 3 programs by week. You know, and all of them is with the recordings, and you know the pressure is there always. You know, we must do very quickly the things, and if we do three programs in a week, this is like to say that we do three times more the repertoire than another orchestras. And this happened, for example, when it's a guest conductor and Nielsen 6 or 9 or any Nielsen, you know, or any piece different, strange. Okay, they go there to my orchestra and the orchestra know the piece because they record it, they play it, they, you know, it's a very good, what to say, it's a bibliotheque, it's a librarian there. It's, all of them know very well the music.
That, it makes it sound like it's the pace of Tanglewood, but just all the time.
Yeah, it's true. This is, it's similar to, but can you imagine, not only in summer, no, but all the weeks
time.
This is amazing.
Yeah. I'm curious about one other thing, if I can ask. When we talked before, we talked a little about coming from Spain, studying in Germany, being around a lot. But I'm curious to go back to talk a little bit about Spain and the audience's relationship to concert music, to classical music. Spain has a very different recent history from a lot of the rest of Europe, a very tough history. And I guess I just wonder, do you feel like, first of all, from the sort of distant past, there was Franco, and then much more recently, there was grave economic difficulty in Spain. And it really made people's lives hard. Do you feel like those times make this kind of music a little bit, I don't know, more valuable, more important to Spanish audiences?
I think so. After the death of Franco, we look each other and say, okay, we must do all. You know, it was nothing there. It was only little orchestra, two orchestras with very good problems, you know, and a lot of problems and nothing, no auditoriums, no. Okay, always we are open the door for all this amazing music, you know, that is in front. It's for this I am very happy because I was living this moment. I was 11 years old when Franco died, and this transition to open the doors and to look all this culture outside was amazing. Was part of my life, you know, and I am a result of this, you know. And you know now in Spain they are in quasi each city amazing auditoriums, beautiful auditoriums. They build a new orchestras, the youth national orchestras, and also the School of Music. This was a grow up amazing because we were needing to do, because before was nothing. You know, it was only the wind vans in the village, you know, no more than this. It's for this, the progression was amazing in the last 25 years. But what happened with, as we were living in a war that was not real, no? We suppose that we can have, you know, money very easy for the banks to buy this and buy this. Always open. It's, for us was, you know, open the door to the disaster in some point of view. That is magical, but it's disaster. And this came later, no, with the crisis and we reduce all this attention to the culture. But and at the moment, still a lot of good focus center. And I think it's impossible to change now after the time of Franco.
Yeah, that's very encouraging. That's great. Well, thank you, Juan Jimena, for a little bit of time today. And I'm looking forward to your Symphony Hall concert that's coming up next season.
January, yes, true.
Yeah. Thanks for your time today.
It's a big pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
And you can hear the concerts Juan Jimena conducted at Tanglewood on demand at classicalwcrb.org. Remember, WCRB in concert on Sunday at 7 p.m. features Boston Baroque in Mozart's The Magic Flute, and we'll have the BSO for you on Saturday at 8 p.m. live from Symphony Hall. You can subscribe to The Answered Question in iTunes or whichever podcast app you use, and you can also listen through WCRB's Facebook, Twitter, and SoundCloud feeds. Thanks to Jakob Rusha and Juan Jimena, as well as the staff of the Boston Symphony for making these conversations possible. I'm Brian McCreath. Thanks for listening.